You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF. Please join me in welcoming Stuart Brioza, Nicole Krasinski, and Jonathan Kaufman to Inforum.
Thank you. That was great. So, hello, everyone. Welcome to tonight's program at Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Jonathan Kaufman. I'm a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle and the author of a book called Hippie Food that's coming out in January. Woo. And I am delighted to be in conversation with two of San Francisco's best chefs and two of my favorites tonight.
Thanks.
So Stuart Brioza and Nicole Krasinski are the co-owners of State Bird Provisions and The Progress. They've received Michelin stars and James Beard awards, and they are happily married to boot. And they're innovators in the food scene, both locally and nationally. And we're here tonight because they have just come out with this amazing first cookbook called The State Bird Provisions. And here to talk about their culinary journeys, the books, and their thoughts on cooking in San Francisco. So welcome, Stuart and Nicole.
Thank you.
Excellent.
So one of the things that I learned a little bit from reading the book was just that you was a little bit about your story of how you guys met and how you got into cooking and how those two acts were in some ways intertwined. Mm. I was wondering if you could tell folks a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, we met in college. We were both studying photography and art at De Anza College down in Cupertino, where I'm from. I was born and raised there, Nicole Los Gatos. And, you know, it was a year-long courtship in
out of the dark room. Took me to New York, Gotham Bar and Grill.
You know, it was this creative... It was kind of a relationship that was based on kind of creative visual arts, and you know, it was long conversations about photography and artists, and at the same time, I cooked for a living. I mean, other than delivering newspapers, that's all I've done for a job. And so Nicole was really into baking at the time and would bake breads at home and bring breads to me. And meanwhile, she was also a vegetarian at the time, but was really quick to... It was a barbecued duck dish. They really sort of did it. And it didn't seem like it was like a conversation at the time. I just said, well, would you be interested in trying this duck dish? And I think you were with your mom, actually, at the time at the restaurant I was working at. And, you know... That was the end of vegetarianism.
that and bacon. And, the other, yeah, the real yeah. gateway meat, bacon.
So, but then after you met, you ended up moving to Michigan to cook. Yeah. And is that sounds like that is sort of
That's
where
right.
you ended up.
That's right. So we moved to Chicago together, and I got a job at a bakery, baking bread for the summer before I started attending the Art Institute of Chicago. And I walked into this bakery and Stuart prepped me on what to say, like, tell them you want a stage, that you'll work for free, like, just be very like effusive and a little bit aggressive. And I was like, okay, this is weird. But so I walked in and the bakery had literally opened the day before, and this woman who had her training at the Art Institute of Chicago and then later went to the CIA for baking and pastry, she had her arm up to here in sourdough starter, and my eyes just started like rolling back in my head, like, whatever it takes, I have to work here. And so she gave me a job staging, and after a month couldn't get rid of me and hired me on. And by the end of the summer, I was like, I am all in. Like, I do not want to do anything but this. So stayed on as a baker and thought that's what I would do forever. I really was passionate about bread, and I sort of like was like pastry chefs. No. Like, they deal in, like, little grams. Like, we are lifting giant bags of flour all day. We have huge muscles. We're sweaty. It's just, like, a whole culture in and of itself. And then Stuart got a job up in northern Michigan at Tapwingo, an amazing restaurant, and town of 400, so there weren't a lot of other options for employment. So I then was sort of thrown into the world of restaurants, and I had no idea what a sheet pan was or what an ice cream machine looked like or how to temper chocolate. So I started training under the pastry chef there, and then he soon after put his notice in. So there I was in the kitchen with three or four pastry books.
A seasonal kind of town where it was like, you know, if you're not locked in with your staffing by June, you are, forget it, right? You're not going to find staff. So Nicole was like, all right, I'm taking it. I'm the pastry chef. I'll bake all the breads. And, you know, and that was the start for her.
And then did the job at Rubicon bring you to San Francisco, or did you come to San Francisco and find the job at Rubicon?
Well, so again, we, you know,
the legendary restaurant downtown, for those of you.
Yeah. You know, after school in New York, and I was doing my internship in Chicago, and that's kind of what took us there. And then this first position is my first chef position up in northern Michigan, this little tiny farming community. You know, we were there for just about 4 years up in northern Michigan. And, you know, at that point it was sort of, you know, our families were kind of, the magnetic pull was bringing us back to California. Same with
the weather.
The weather in December is, I remember coming back, flying back to San Jose Airport, and, you know, I left northern Michigan. It was negative 18 degrees and really cold, and I got off the plane and it was 62 in San Jose, and we drove to the beach, and I sort of called Nicole at that point. I said, I think it's time. We need to come back. So we actually weren't sure where we were going to land, and we moved back to the Bay Area. We were thinking Southern California was an option, or Northern, and we just got tired of trying to think about it, and so we just put a stake in the ground and rented an apartment in Noe Valley at the time, and we did not have jobs. Just through good correspondence, and, you know, we knew, I guess, the right people, we were put in touch with Larry Stone and Drew Neaport.
And they just happened to be looking for both pastry chef and chef, so it worked out really well.
It was a good little package deal. Mm-hmm. I think that, and the fact that we were like, whatever you want to pay us is fine. Uh-huh. Yeah. 42K a year? You got it. From there. As long as I get to work with my wife, and, well, at the time we weren't married, but we got to work together, and you know, we were there for 5 years, nearly 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And then you kind of took a break from restaurants, and you did catering.
Yeah.
And why did you stay out long, and why? What brought you back? What convinced you it was time to come back?
Well, I think the idea was that we were going to take like 1 year. You know, it was 5 years, really kind of just intensive cooking, intense closing of an institution. So that was kind of just emotionally taxing, and we had just kind of done nothing but cook. So, you know, we had managed to put away some money, and we said, let's just take a year and not make decisions. And we were able to do some traveling, which just kind of reinvigorated our spirit and whatnot. And we were also able to really do some cool things for some special people in the city, you know, who at the time needed some assistance in their kitchen. So we just kind of get random calls and be like on call, you know, to work with kind of some various chefs and whatnot. And at the same time, we were getting calls from people who wanted a dinner party for 10 at their house. And then that just didn't really stop, right? It continued, you know, so we had kind of a good steady stream of potential catering gigs. And, you know, we would maybe do two a month or so, and it was just enough to pay rent. And the leftovers would feed us for a couple of weeks. And we had all this time on our hands, and we sort of really took advantage of the time. And used it as just sort of personal growth time, really, right? Whether health or
pottery.
You know, pottery. I was doing a lot of ceramics at the time. And you know, 1 year turned into 3.5 years. We had gotten married during that time, and we had a son. And it was really about the time we had been starting to really focus on a restaurant. We were looking for spaces. We were working on our business plan, and you know, all of that goes into it. It's a full-time job for sure. We found a space, and we went through all the way to the very end, and we realized that this just was not going to happen, right? The zoning of the area was not in accordance to having a retail operation, but we learned a lot, right? We learned how to negotiate a bit. And it happened about 2 weeks before our son was born, and then he was born. It was like, okay, like I think we got to do this. It's now or never. Right, and I remember getting on my bicycle and riding around the city, and you know, while Nicole was home, and I was like on, you know, no sleep, and you know, neither of us were, but I was like, all right, I'm just gonna ride around and just look for spaces, anything. Hello, you know, and I met our broker at a space, and then she kind of sent me down the street to where State Bird is now, and was like, it's an empty space, just peek in the window. And, you know, if it's something that interests you. And so desperation as well kicked in, which was like, yeah, it's interesting. Let's do it. Set me up. You know, let's get an appointment.
Well, at the time, the building, I don't know if any of you were at State Bird in the early years, because it still looked much like this, sort of like a crime scene. Like the front had all these drip marks coming from the windows above, and the whole thing had been boarded up with graffiti and just didn't look that sexy. Then we went inside and it looked worse. Actually,
yeah.
The Stafford portion, which is where the landlord took us through, it smelled like a dirty grease trap. The walls were painted dark purple, and
And then the old Adidas store, which was lime green, mm-hmm. right? So you're going through these various mazes of the space, and it was like, what is this building?
And never having built a restaurant, we didn't have the eyes that we now have, where you're like, you could do anything here, knock these walls down, do this. We're just like, oh my God, this is horrible. And then he, to his credit, you know, left the gem for the end and took us around into what is now the Progress space. And it has these beautiful ceilings and windows and light coming in. And we're like, oh my God, this is the restaurant we want.
And the character of like the criteria we were really looking for was something that had structural character and some history behind it, and you know, it really matched all of that. And you sort of stood in the middle of at the time the Progress, and could see just the tops of the trees moving in the wind. And at that point, you could just kind of put your dreamy goggles on and realize that you're anywhere in San Francisco. It doesn't matter, like you're in this space, and it really takes you in. And so the landlord said, "Great. But I'm going to get you started on this space, which is State Bird, that nasty smelling purple, you know." And it was like, really? It was an old pizzeria. It had a hood. It had the zoning already. So there was no city bureaucracy to get through. But somehow we managed to finagle this cat's cradle of a lease that tied both restaurants together. And really, I don't know, we did something that turned out to be incredibly intelligent. and we took this space that was, you know, and we had no intentions of actually opening up State Bird. It was just never, the idea was just to do this family style restaurant that was like big platters and shareable and fun. And you know, and then of course I was like, but it has to be at the Progress space because that looks like a place where you can enjoy these dishes, right? Like the food's going to match it. And so at the time, I mean, it kind of turned back into what we were doing currently, which was these catering events. And there was a big, it seemed like every party that people were asking us to do, they wanted something very casual. They wanted lots of different tastes and bites, and it to be substantial enough to last through the dinner hour, which, you know, essentially is like a 12-course walking tasting menu, right? And so we were doing these 12 to 15 bite-sized appetizer or hors d'oeuvre parties, and they were awesome, you know, because we could almost do anything. You'd have three or four elements in the party that were like home runs, right? Anything with crab or, you know, something with burrata cheese or something. You know, we could really just kind of, you could predict those dishes that everyone's going to love. And then we can throw in like a lamb's tongue dish or, you know, fried quail, you know, which, you know, not everybody was totally into at the time. But we could do these things that were, you know, challenged a bit and led a lot of creativity. And we thought, well, wow, how do we turn that into a restaurant? And, you know, we just looked at different, you know, ideas, hors d'oeuvre parties, tapas, izakaya, sushi counters, and then, of course, dim sum. And dim sum is what made the most sense. It was taking this kind of, you know, the flavors that we were comfortable creating and putting them on carts and trays and bringing it to your table, which, you know, we can sell a lot of food that way.
Quickly.
What was interesting about reading the book, because I waited 5 or 6 weeks to go there, but like, it sounded like the first month was kind of a disaster, but because of psychology, not because of your cooking. Like, you learn something about how people order food and think about the meal during that period.
There was a lot of learning curves, for sure.
Yeah, the format changed every week for the first 6 weeks, and Stuart would stay up until 3 a.m, like, just reimagining it and come into service and tell the service, okay, tonight we're going to do it this way, and they would all be like, okay, chef, let's do it. Everyone
yeah,
was so
somehow
fired
they believed
up.
It.
And then finally, at 6 weeks into it, we're like, okay, it's starting to feel like this is the direction. Like, people are having fun. We're having fun. It's all clicking.
What were you providing them that was kind of getting, you know, what did it take understanding about how diners are eating to kind of make that?
Well,
make that
it's
work?
Really, the first 2 weeks we had no menu printed. So there was nothing that you ordered from. And, you know, that was like, we are genius. We're so genius, we don't even have to print a menu. We can just do this. And I just thought, I was like, I'm like so high on like the paint fumes of a restaurant. And just like going, you know, you're just working nonstop, so you just sort of, there's nothing rational about opening up a restaurant. And, you know, it's just, it sort of had this feel, but we were also like, there was like 50 people, and it was really easy to make sure kind of everybody saw everything, and it was a smaller menu. And of course, that totally backfired one night, because I remember someone, a guest, and maybe I think someone we knew, friendly with, and, you know, they're like, well, we never saw the state bird, and that's the name of your restaurant, right? Like, we really wanted the fried quail. And so at that point, I was like, wow, we should figure out how they can definitely get that if they would like. And so we rolled out kind of a version and menus and such. And, you know, I mean, there's no apps, there's no entrees to the restaurant, right? So there's no formula, so to speak. But we were trying to figure out, like, well, what is it design-wise and categorically-wise that we could, that the buy-in became a little easier, and that there was an element of food that you can control or command, which led to the name The Commandables, which, you know, the diner. I think I actually read that on a Yelp review about 40 days into it, and it was like, well, there's a small menu of commandables. And I was like, commandables, that's a great name. So it matches provisions. And so, like, it just sort of, like, it really came together quite nice. And pancakes, and, you know, was not even a category until I think one night we had 3 pancakes mm-hmm. going, and I was like, well, I think that qualifies for its own category. And so, you know, that became a thing, and we just made it, and it stuck, you know. So little things along the way that were just sort of like paying attention, we're just in the moment paying attention, and slowly they started to take more shape. And Yeah, I think we started the menu. It was probably 12 dishes or so. It was a pretty small menu of items and really wacky things, too. You know, our first flatbread that we had on the menu, which we always wanted to have a flatbread on the menu. It was this oxtail braise, this flatbread that we would cook on the plancha.
Roll it to order.
Oh, roll it to order. Like, yeah.
Myself and my assistant just there rolling, order in. Okay, roll the flatbread quick.
Yeah, well, we had this idea of like rolling it to order, like, you know, kind of like a window, like in, you know, Chinese restaurant with ducks hanging down and they're cutting your duck and you're seeing that. Or, you know, there's the Taiwan restaurant on Clement Street that the guy's making dumplings and in the window and you can see it. And I was like, oh, well, what if our thing is that we're rolling flatbread? And I was like, Nicole, can you roll flatbread to order? And you know, it worked when we were doing like 40 or 50 covers. But the dish was $8. It was this flatbread and it was an oxtail kind of
marmalade, right?
Yeah, like curried oxtail kind of dobe. There was a sunchoke puree and there was a lentil dal. And I just remember thinking, I was like, this is a lot of work for $8. And I mean, you know, braising oxtail, picking oxtail, then making peeling sunchokes and like lentils. And I was like, I was applying, we were applying this Rubicon like philosophy of mentality of the kitchen to like a place that we were running. I mean, our business plan was modeled at a $35 check average. And so, you know, I mean, that was like, that's all in, right? That's like drinks and everything we were selling. You know, I wanted everything to be the best bargain ever. And, you know, it was $2 beers for a half beer and whole beer. I mean, that's a whole another story of how we grew up and kind of quickly, like, we were going to not be able to pay our bills if we do this. But there was a lot of those neat stories that kind of lent into the creation and the evolution of Stay Bird.
Yeah, we also pretty quickly figured out that if you put food in front of someone, they're 95% chance they're going to take it if they see it and they smell it. Whereas if they read it on a menu, they might not go for the tofu kimchi stew because they don't have any like idea maybe what that is. And we tested it one night and sure enough, we didn't sell any. We had it on the menu and at 9 o'clock Stuart was like, let's walk this around. And we sold a dozen in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So there are certain dishes that you always, we just put in front of people knowing like, you just can't describe it well enough. You have to smell it and then you'll know how delicious.
It's sort of the visual of food and the wording of food, right? Like sometimes on a menu when you read it, you're like, how does that translate? What does it look like? What's the size of it? How do I eat it? And so, I mean, I think that, you know, in hindsight, some of the success of Stay Bird is that we took that thing, the tapas, the T word that was, you know, basically kind of just ruined, I think, in this country, because no one, even chefs in restaurants, there was so many like directions, like, well, how much food do I order? There's three of us. Is there going to be two or three pieces? You know, it's all of these things that were like, you're confused as a diner. Like we really understand when we go to a steakhouse, like what a 22-ounce steak looks like and a baked potato and a salad, or just a, you know, where it's done, it's pasta, pizza. You know, we really understand that. But when we start throwing in these other ideas of like tapas, which is like, I look at like Spain is an entire country that understands tapas from, you know, 3 or 4 years old, right? I mean, it takes a whole country to really understand that kind of that type of dining. I mean, really, it's supported by a whole country. It's accepted. It's part of the culture. And we were introducing someone else's culture into traditional American restaurants, and it was very confusing. So State Bird's sort of idea of putting food in front of you, giving you the choice right then and there, is like, you know, has taken the tapas idea and made it work for the American diner.
Well, one of the things you write in the book is that kind of struck me. A little paragraph I'm going to read back to you.
Oh.
Since our restaurant fit into no category, everything was fair game. My pantry could include such disparate ingredients as sambal and brown butter, Japanese pickled plums and sauerkraut, kimchi and the awesome Italian oil made by pressing olives and lemons together. We never quite figured out what our food would be. We just kept cooking it. So I'm curious, you know, with that kind of that broad a palette, like, how did you end up shaping? Have you figured out what your food is?
Yeah,
it's got to be delicious. You know, that's the first rule.
Well, isn't that the hardest thing for chefs to describe what their food is? Mm. Do you find that? I mean, even as a writer, how do you describe what category? It's not like it's Northern Italian by way of California, right? Or, I mean, you know, taking regional cuisine from somewhere else and bringing it into an area is a lot easier. It's a nice category, right? It fits, it's shaped into a nice box. And as American chefs, we're challenged big time with this idea as to, like, what is our local cuisine. And I like to think that our food is it matches the demographics of what the Bay Area is, right? There's a lot of this kind of flavor, these flavors that are taken from the markets that even, you know, I grew up with too, Cupertino and my family hosting Japanese exchange students, and the school that I went to that was just populated by many different cultures. And you think about, like, slumber parties, and the best ones were, you know, my Chinese friends whose grandmother came from China who doesn't speak English, and she cooks all day, and the house smells so fantastic. And you're eating kind of exotic foods, that things like soy sauce to a young, you know, kid is kind of exotic because it's this flavor and the way it's mixed and gingers and things of that. And all of a sudden, this is your palate too that you're growing up with, right? Without knowing it culturally, right? And so it's kind of an interesting place to think about in San Francisco, and being that we're both Bay Area kids, that we have these flavors in our restaurant. So
paired with the abundance that's all around, like our neighbor, we didn't have these trees, but our neighbor did, and we would go over there in the season. There was a cherry and a plum and a walnut and a pecan and a persimmon and a pomegranate tree that went into our yard. And so you have that with these other, you sort of mesh it all together, and that's really state bird.
Mm-hmm. Well, and starting young, like in restaurants, I started cooking in 1990. And I remember, like, California cuisine was Mediterranean cuisine. And I was like, well, what's a Mediterranean person look like? What is that? You know, and really, like, I don't know. What is that? I mean, is there Mediterranean? Or, I mean, and you start thinking, is a lot of Southern French and Italian and a little trickle of Spanish at the time, and lots of fresh ingredients, right? And organics was still pretty new. So mostly organics were a lot of beat up vegetables and overripe bananas that I remember, you know, in the grocery, right? You're writing a book on hippie food, so.
That was a badge of honor.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, and mesclun mix, right? Uh-huh. That was my favorite. Yeah, big boxes of mesclun mix. Try telling, I was 16, so it was like, what is mesclun mix? But, you know, and this is terrible. I still don't know exactly what our food is, but I definitely think it's, you know, it's the demographic cuisine. Mm-hmm.
And yet that makes, you know, sense. life imposes limitations as well, and especially the format you chose. And what were some of the ways that you ended up being limited that kind of spurred you to be more creative?
Mm. Well, it's definitely, how many of you have been to State Bird? Lots of people. Okay, oh, so you know there's an onslaught of food, and you can have within, and I do this, it's my restaurant, I over order and I overeat every single time, and you have 15 different things on your table at once, and none of them necessarily go together, but they all sort of do, because they're all these, like, one or two bite, like, intense high acid and texture and kind of flavors that you don't want to eat a lot of. You just want those two bites, and that's perfect, because you have the next thing that you have to get to before it's too late and the tray is coming around with something else that you have to get to. Mm-hmm. So a lot of how we design food is dictated by the method of eating and the way it's served.
It's got a lot of competition on the table, right? So each dish is kind of vying for that. So subtlety it gets lost really quick. And I think our first chawanmushi that we put on on the menu. It was really elegant and delicate and totally like subtle. And people were like, what was that? What was that thing I just ate? You know, and they still say that because not everyone knows what a chawanmushi is. But it's like chawanmushi with like a big scoop of like chopped up clams and sambal and like chili juice. So it's like got this like you eat it and it's saying something. It's competing, you know.
For those of you who don't know, chawanmushi is sort of a steamed egg custard.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
It's a very lovely, delicate dish.
Traditionally. Yeah. Not in our hands.
Yeah.
You're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
So as I understand it, you know, you handle the sweet and you handle the savory. And yet it seems like, you know, with the flatbreads and pancakes, there are things that you also kind of collaborate on.
Yeah. So the pancakes is a good example. We started making those pancakes at these dinner parties before the restaurant opened. And we wanted to work on like a Korean style pancake, but tiny and not with kimchi. So we subbed in sauerkraut and at some point added ricotta to make it even more luxurious.
I think the first one was sweet corn.
It was.
Oh, damn.
It was, yeah.
That mm-hmm. one, yeah.
So that was an instance where Stuart said, I want to make this. It has flour in it, so can you write me a recipe? there are a few desserts that I had done in the past where it was more like, I need help with this. What do you think I should do? And we would talk about it. And those are still some of the, I think, the best desserts I've ever made. So when we collaborate, they're always like, wow, this is the best example of this thing because we have both of our brains working at it together.
We have, like, back in Michigan, we were doing, we did this really, like, kind of out there. And this is 2001, so now it's probably just, you know, it's salt and straw. But it's at that time, it was pretty progressive of a dish. And it was our very first, like, full-on collaborative dessert. Well, it was dish that happened to be a dessert. It was very savory and very sweet all on one plate. And it was this little fig tarte tatin that Nicole made. It was just a beautiful tarte tatin. And then we did an aged balsamic ice cream with gorgonzola, dolce, sea salt, arugula salad, right? This is Michigan, too, by the way.
you know. And not Detroit or
no,
this Chicago
is like,
suburb.
No, this is northern Michigan, like, you know, town of 400. Your dishwashers are 15 years old and are basically, like, avoiding farm work, you know, by working for us. That was the best job in town. I'm going to go wash dishes with these cool kids so I don't have to pick rocks out of the ground for the combines. So it was, and it was like really, I thought it was a very gutsy, I mean, it was a very gutsy, this very savory dessert, which was, you know, maybe not quite as common, you know, at the time. And since then, I mean, I still remember tasting it today, you know, because it was just such a beautiful flavors and really at the time just kind of matched our curiosities and kind of intensities as well.
But that also, that moment of tasting it, now everything is set at that bar. Like now every time I make a dessert, it's that's imprinted and it's like, that has to be that good. Like if it's not that good, we need to like totally scrap it, or we need to figure out what it needs to make it that good, because there's no reason to compromise because we know it can be that good.
So that's one of the things I've always really liked about your desserts is they're pitched kind of, they're not too sweet. I mean, there are a lot of things going on in a very simple format.
Yes.
And what kind of testing does it require for you to hit that point?
It not as much as it used to, but like growing up in Los Gatos, sort of the hippie mom, we weren't allowed to eat sugar. It was like Halloween, you got one candy and the rest magically disappeared the next day.
And oh, so, that's cruel.
I didn't grow up like with my palate wasn't attuned to sweet. So that's another reason why I was like pastry chefs. No, no, no. And then when I became one, I was making desserts to my palate, which was naturally on the lesser level. And I have to say, like, as I've grown into this job, I feel like they're getting sweeter, but still, they're still much less sweet than many. So it's just as when Stuart designs a dish, it's all about finding that balance of acid, sweetness, and texture. So you just, we worked on one today. The ladies in the pastry kitchen presented something to me that they had worked on, and I took one bite and it was like, I need to eat this whole thing. It was like that moment where they had gotten just like, there was a little booze in the cream and there was some fresh fruit and there was a puff pastry and brown butter and like all the things coming together.
So, you know, how you also, I mean, I've asked about collaboration, but then also how do you keep your responsibilities separate so you don't like strangle each other? I mean, like, how do you work together, you know, in two restaurants?
Yeah.
Well, we've always had separate. We've always had separate kitchens.
Because restaurants are not, oh, that's good. Okay. Yeah, they're not
Michigan,
like easygoing places.
No. In Michigan, my kitchen was like down a hallway
from
the Savory
right.
kitchen. At Rubicon, yeah. we were on different floors.
Yeah.
And we actually, Statebird was the first time that we ever worked next to each other, but we were opening a restaurant. And so it was like, it didn't matter. Like, we didn't see each other. And to this day, we maybe see each other 2 hours a day because there's just so much going on and we're sort of on different schedules and interacting with different, we have 100 employees. So there's always, we're positioned in different locations throughout the 10,000 square feet that we have.
Yeah. They'll be like just passing at this point and less tasting of each other's food because we have our teams now, right? And they're so demanding of our time. And we demand their full attention in many ways, right? I mean, that's just how it's been set up. Demand is such a strong word there, but it's really set up like in a way that we're so, you know, when I'm at State Bird, it's just all State Bird. And when I'm in the Progress, it's all Progress, or when I'm in the commissary, it's all commissary. And what we're just like, I don't even go. I go into the pastry kitchen for some snacks, really. throughout the day.
Periodic.
Just checking in, tasting, and kind of doing that nod, like I'm really like thinking about what you're doing, but I'm just satisying my instant crave for some sugar.
I graze Garmager station. There's like little bits of salad and pickles stolen throughout the day.
Yeah. So Statebird was, you know, it was around, you were open for about 8 months, doing well, and then Bon Appetit came. And so Bon Appetit named them the best new restaurant in America, and life changed.
Crazy.
So yeah, could you, you know, other than the problem of reservations, it was never possible to get there, the lines, and, you know, like, how did that change what you were doing, and...
Yeah, it was, it was August 15th, 2012.
You remember where you were?
Oh, yeah.
Still remember, yeah. And we knew that something special was happening because they had spent an awful lot of time taking photographs and, like, working on layout. And, I mean, they were sort of like, you know, and we were, you know, pulling an extra beer or two, you know, to make sure that those pictures looked really good. So we knew something special was going to happen, but we didn't really know. And at that time, I mean, I think that was a pretty new list, right?
Yeah.
Maybe 2 or 3 years that it had been going on. And when you're not in restaurants, at least in our world, we just took a sabbatical leave out of kind of all the press. So, you know, we had no magazine subscriptions, you know, we didn't really buy cookbooks during that time. I mean, we were pretty cautious with how we were spending money and had a pretty decent library of our own. So we were really out of the loop as to who the big, you know, magazine people and who the players, so to speak, were. I didn't even know Andrew Knowlton was like the first, 3 months that we were there. And I don't know if anybody dined at State Bird, we had this great idea that we had a standing bar Does anybody remember the standing bar? Okay, I really loved it. No one else did.
Except for Andrew.
But Andrew did. And actually, several of like some of our best guests and most frequent guests that have really evolved into great friends of the restaurant and us were like standing bar like devotees. And what that was it was the big wood counter that we had, and we would just set it like a place setting, and you stood and hung out with us in the kitchen. I thought it was genius. There's this restaurant in Spain, Quimet y Quimet, that is like this little hole in the wall that has no seats, and it's a vermouth bar, and you order food and you stand and eat. And I just remember loving that. But the Andrew Knowlton was right next to us, and we were taking care of him all night. And he kept asking questions like, "Oh, so is the the provisions on the state bird, is that like a sous vide?" And I was like, "Well, kind of, but not really. It's a sous vide is more of a pureed sauce of onions." And then I was like, "Well, are you in the industry?" You know, it seemed like a realistic question because he's this dude asking me about sous vide, and he kept asking like really kind of like somewhat intricate questions. And then he was just like, nah, and I had no idea who he was. And finally, several chefs came in, and I think guys like they actually did an, maybe it was an Inforum. I actually think it was an Inforum because I saw them up there and I was reminded. And it was Brett Cooper, who's an old sous chef of ours at Rubicon, Brandon Ju, and
Danny Bowen,
maybe at the time. They came in to State Bird and they're like, "I've been trying to get a hold of you. Andrew Knowlton's coming. That's him standing right there." And I was like, "Who's that?" And, bon appetit. And so then I went up to him and I was like, "So you like to cook?" And that was really fun. And, and we just had he had a good time. He got the real experience. There was no catering to this guy because I didn't know who he was. When that day arrived, we did not know that we were taking the number one spot, and we're both in bed, and both of our phones started to kind of bzzz, we turned it off and opened the computer and kind of did the countdown, 10. All right, oh, that's good. Nicole's like, "Come on, all right." And we get down to like number two, and she screams because it's not us, right? And I'm sort of like,
it's like the Miss America moment.
Yeah,
it was.
It was, I think. And our son, who was now one and almost two, right? And he's in bed with us, and he starts screaming.
Yeah, he starts crying because he thinks like I'm
crying,
injured because I'm like,
his mom is screaming. Wow. It's just this like chaos. And then I was just like, she's like, grabs my hand and just like hits the fast forward button and it's like the number one, and we just sort of were like, "Whoa, what does this mean?" And so we start like, what does that mean? It's like a big deal. And we get into the restaurant and like Candace is like, "Chef, the phone is just like, it won't stop ringing." And she's just like, taking a reservation and like shutting it down. And it's just like every time it slammed down, it would ring. And people were like, "Your reservation system's broken." And, just like going off and yelling at us. And we're all yelling at each other. We're trying to figure it out. And like, it was just like mayhem all morning. And we're like, "Well, it's okay. All right." But we were 30 days booked, and that booked out pretty shortly. And the phone literally, it just wouldn't stop. And we added another 30 days of reservations, and it bought us some time. It allowed people to make reservations, stop calling, give us a little moment to like kind of gather our senses and figure out what our game plan was. And then it was like mayhem. It was awesome. It was like this energy that came into the restaurant that was, it was like the greatest gift. And I think of it as that, it was a gift, and it was a bit of a lotto. I mean, I think, you know, how do you gauge what the best new restaurant is? And at the time, we were just, you know, trying to, you know, figure it out, and that we were getting better as a business. And, you know,
there was a moment that first night, this is when I still worked the pancake station, that there was a little glass shield on a top of a small piece of wood, like right as you walked in the front door, and at 8 o'clock Stuart was like, get that thing out of here and put two people on there. And I were like walking through the dining room carrying this piece of glass, and then we set two people there, and we called it the sweet spot because it was right that you could see the pastries being made right in front of you.
That is right. Mm-hmm. We like had to pull out like a screwdriver drill and like take it off, and we basically had like a standing bar. That standing bar became really popular, by the way. We did have seats by that time, but the standing, we ended up creating this additional standing bar that sat four people on about 2 feet. And it was about 6 inches wide, and people were happy to stand there. And so we would turn that, you know, we would do three turns. It was 12 covers on this, on basically a railing, right? And and like 12 covers, like it was, you know, it was serious. So it really, I think what really came out of it is that after we kind of steered through the tsunami that hit us, and it was that, just that, that we were able to come up for air and kind of go, wow, State Bird is really going to grow into the restaurant it was meant to be. And it just kind of gave us this newfound leverage. We were no longer describing what and how we did it and answering the often question, which was, why do you do it this way? Why can't we just have a menu? We didn't have to answer that anymore. That was probably the best gift right there.
So we're about to start asking questions. The public can ask questions. I think it's over here. There's a microphone back here. She's waving her hand if you want to line up and ask some questions. I guess we didn't get to talk about the progress or the, you know, State Bird seed, the snack that came out with. You can all ask these questions, or about Michelin stars, or what it's like to cook in San Francisco. Hint. Right now. So I guess one last question would be about the cookbook. Like, what was it like to translate, you know, all of that experience into a book?
Well, we had some good, having never done this before, we had some people that had a lot of experience doing it. Thankfully, all the 10 speed people were amazing. And of course, our author, JJ Good, who we're chefs, we're not authors. And he magically captured our voices separately in the book. And you can really see that here's Stuart talking, here's Nicole talking, different tones. And then of course, Ed Anderson and his photography is just like, so perfect. So
yeah, it was a really fun process and neat to kind of take these recipes and try to keep them and preserve them in a way that that other people can replicate. Mm-hmm. Or try to.
And what do you want people to do with them? Or do you have a goal? Like, when you sort of think about how does somebody want to cook from this?
That's a good question. It's not that we didn't write it so people could become a better cook, but perhaps that would come out of it. And if you read through, there's a lot of, like, what I think the book is really good at is that there's a lot of like secrets that lie within the book when you dig deep. And it's kind of one of those books that you sort of are able to read when you're able to read between the lines. I think that there's some magic in there that will, you know, perhaps kind of inform some of your cooking.
All right. Do we have some questions?
What would your last meal be?
Yeah. Yeah, probably a taco.
Nicole?
Well, it's funny that you asked this because I was thinking about it. We get asked this question often for different at different events, and you're always like, what is the best answer for that question? Because it's a hard one. And there is this black cod onigiri that we make at the restaurant, and it like literally I'm in the back hiding my container of it, and all the chefs know to like give me some to take home. It's my special.
Hello, I have two questions. I know that's not allowed, but one is easy and one is hard. The first one, Why bow?
Bow.
Very interested by that. Mm-hmm. And then the second one. So given the news recently, and everyone has read No Reservations, kitchens are a notoriously wild place, all the Harvey Weinstein stuff, what do you guys think about that? And, you know, in terms of kitchen, what happens in the kitchen and stuff?
Cool. Great questions.
So I'll start with a bow. I'll take the bow. That was something that we used to do at State Burton, and it's in the cookbook, but in a much larger format. So as we sort of were, you know, exploring this, like, we're sort of like a funky kind of dim sum, but not restaurant. I wanted to do a dessert that was knotted to the carts and trays, and so I made a sweet version of bao. It's basically a giant profiterole with a crunchy top, and then we would serve a condiment next to it, so you would tear it apart and eat it with a condiment. But for obviously events like this, we need it to be like one or two biter. And the curry pastry cream is not in the book, but we serve the bao, and it's done with like curry sauce. So I'd love it, like curry and lemon zest and that cookie.
It was amazing.
Yeah. Thank you.
I guess I'll take that. Yeah, there's a lot of, so much is happening all over the country. You know, kitchens and restaurants can be a safe place. And we work really hard at our restaurants to we think about culture all the time. We think about the staff experience. This is something that's really important. I also do feel that, you know, like these writings, and different areas of the country will have different relationships with this. And we're very lucky to be working in California, where we're very progressive as a state and how we treat people, especially in San Francisco. I think kitchens are changing rapidly, not because they have to, but because they have to. And I know that kind of sounds bizarre. You know, culture is our number one work effort. The culture that is behind the doors. Nicole and I, our partners, Elizabeth and Jason, our management team, we spend hours, lots of hours, on what that culture means, and it's how we interact with people. I think Nicole and I are you know, very present in our restaurants. Our interaction with our staff is, yeah, I don't know. It's just such an important part of the culture. We also think that happy staff make happy food, and I think that there's a lot of truth to that. And part of, you know, I'd like to think, and a good portion of our success at both restaurants is because of our staff, the way that they make the food taste better, the way that the service staff, the wait staff, you know, interact with guests and make them feel really welcome, wanted, and warm, and humored a little bit. I mean, we got to bring humor to the situation as often as we possibly can, to just create a place where, you know, you get away for a couple hours. But, you know, I call it the 90-10 rule. 90% of our efforts go into our staff. 10% go into our guest experience. We really think about it in that ratio, and it's a very high ratio of staff experience. Not to say that the guest experience is not important, but you're with us for 2 hours, right? We're not going to change the world in 2 hours. We're not saving lives. We're not trying to. But when I have staff that have been with us for 5 years, we're pretty imperative in their life, and that's an important recognition. So I think it all goes back to culture, the work culture, the restaurant culture. I hope that answers a little bit. Treating people like humans. Yeah, good humans.
Hi there. I have a question about the Michelin star. There was recently a French chef who decided to give up his French Michelin star because it was hard work. It's very hard work to get the Michelin star, but it's a nightmare to try and maintain it. How does it affect the way that you run your restaurant, your attitude towards food, the way you treat your customers, to try and maintain that excellence?
It's a tough one, too. I think it comes down to... well, I remember we had a fancy couple come in, the State Bird. And after like two or three dishes, they walked out. And I was like really like crushed by this. And this was not that long ago, maybe about a year ago, by the notion. And they came in because they had heard about how good the restaurant was and that it was a Michelin-starred restaurant. They like walked out, and I just didn't get that. And that was, you know, the expectation of what a Michelin star restaurant is changing so much. And I think State Bird has had a significant effort. I'd like to think that the Michelin star is the residue of design, right? It's not that we're working towards it. That was never our efforts. I felt so great about wearing shorts the first time I did in the kitchen. I was like, I've never done this before. This is good. This feels great. I don't do it, but once in a while I will. Maybe a couple of times a year. It's really hot, and damn it, I'm going to wear shorts in the kitchen. And I don't do it with this idea that I'm rebelling against a Michelin star or that I'm proud of it. I just think that, you know, we do things really well and we've been recognized for that. You know, once you have that, it's like a 3-star rating from the Chronicle. You don't want a 2.5-star. You really work hard. It's hard. It is hard work. I think the European model of Michelin and the reality of how it fits into what the European restaurant is much different than what it is in the States. Sometimes I don't understand it. I don't understand how they can stay in business, to be honest. I don't understand the metrics of it. You know, you do one seating a night, and yeah, it's expensive. But, you know, I know many restaurants that are expensive in the States that do 2 to 3 seatings a night, and that's because we have to, right? We have to so that we can survive. I don't know. I mean, the Michelin star is, I'm certainly not throwing it back. I'm super proud of it. If anything, it's like, you know, between the night before that the announcement is made or the call is made at about 10:30 is where I get nervous, because I'm like, oh, what if we don't get it again? Because what does that say to your staff? What does it do for morale? You know, I think our food is fantastic. You know, whatever the strivance is, there are restaurants out there that are very driven towards Michelin stars. And there are restaurants like ours that, you know, we receive them because we're just doing good work. And I love that. And I love that. I love being in that place, you know, that we are recognized as that. But I do not like to ever be told what to do by Michelin. And I don't want to ever have that sort of, you know, I don't want the restaurant. I want the restaurant to be run by the people that work in it. That's key. Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
Thanks for coming and speaking tonight. My question's kind of around what's it like to cook in San Francisco. This is weird. More specifically, I grew up in the neighborhood you guys have your restaurant in.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
What is it like to join the Western Addition, which is a very unique neighborhood with a very storied past? Like, I was thrilled when you moved into the crap pizza place.
Yeah.
And I know people had a lot of feelings when Harput's closed.
Yeah.
What has it been like for you guys to join the Western Addition and join San Francisco overall in the restaurant scene?
Well, we moved in, so now we live there too. So we love the Western Addition.
Yeah.
It was one of the, even though we didn't know anything about the neighborhood and had never really spent any time there, before we signed the lease, we thought, okay, we should spend some time in this neighborhood and kind of get to know it. And we would just walk that block and the few blocks around it different times of day and night to get the vibe. And it was clean and well lit and all sorts of different people coming in the public transportation right there. And what we realized is you can get anywhere in the city from there so easily and so efficiently. And there's parking garages, which there aren't in a lot of neighborhoods, that our guests appreciate. And just kind of all these little things in Japantown being right there. So all these different people and cultures and neighborhoods coming together right there felt very like we felt comfortable doing that, putting our restaurant there and spending a lot of time and money. We go there every day. And before, we had gone downtown every day and never really, we hadn't had a connection with Montgomery between Sacramento between Sansom and Montgomery. We never felt like that was never our neighborhood, but it was definitely became apparent very quickly that the Western Addition was.
I have a little follow-up question, if I may. I'm just curious, you know, the Yoshi's has had trouble, Yoshi's Club has had trouble finding a new tenant, and 1300 just closed down. And so there, what do you think is it going to take for the city to help bring some more vitality to that area while preserving legacy businesses?
That's such an interesting question. I think that we heard that a lot when we moved in, that, you know, the city's not doing enough for our neighborhood or what it was. And we never went in with that idea that the city's going to really make us who we are. You know, I think a lot of it is just bringing some, I think still like, making it a place that is can be viable to small businesses is what's going to do it. And it goes back. It's the people who are going to, you know, help make that area, rather than the city getting overly involved and say, we're just going to pump money in to this and we're going to kind of blow it up and create sort of an inauthentic area. I think authentic, or, you know, if there is such a word to be used, comes through just time and time over and over again of people doing things versus it like, here you go, we've created an authentic neighborhood, which I feel has been the biggest challenge in the city. I think the big thing is, you know, the Fillmore Jazz, man, I wish those jazz clubs were still around. I mean, that was one of the biggest losses, I think, to that neighborhood, you know, years ago. I mean, so much history and rich history and great, great musicians. It was a part of what it was on their tours, right? And, you know, but to try to bring back the jazz district when what do you relate to it? I mean, what you're going to look at? There's no clubs. I mean, there's the Boom Boom Room. That's awesome. It's still there. We love going into it, you know. There's the Fillmore Auditorium. But where are these clubs that everybody's... I mean, what is the Jazz District? And my feeling is like, maybe it's time to turn that page. And what is the Fillmore going to be? We have to, because it's been stripped, built back up with a lot of ugliness. But there's still a lot of great people in the area, and it's just, it's taking time. It's taking a little bit of time. I mean, the block that we're on, we're starting to see a lot less empty storefronts, for sure, and that's exciting. Mm-hmm. And I thought five years would be about that time, and it has been, and it's certainly cleaned up too. It's even cleaner than what it was.
So we have room for one more question. Time for one more question.
I'm actually very amazed by statehood provision and the progress side by side, but they're so distinctive from each other. Mm-hmm. And just wanted to ask how you guys do it. In fact, those are two restaurants with very different personalities. And in terms of the number of dishes and the permutations and whatnot, and I'm just amazed by how much creative power you have to invest into two restaurants. So how
it's
do
a
you
lot.
Yeah,
it is. Thank you for recognizing that. First off, you know, I think we look at the restaurants as extensions of themselves. You know, it used to, I think when a chef had two restaurants, it was like fine dining and casual. And I don't look at either of them as that. I mean, I think that they're equal dining, just different sort of attitudes. I think that, you know, if we had one giant menu, we could cook all the food we possibly want. You would have state bird progress provisions. But that's kind of the idea. They're two different restaurants. They're very distinctively unique, but there's so many elements to them that come together that are like, wow, you could really see this. If we served it or cut it up a little differently, we could serve this at State Bird, right? Or take this dish from State Bird and serve it at the Progress. Actually, we did. We served the State Bird at Progress when we were doing our recent remodel. And it looked good. It looked really good. It sold too well. I'm so glad we took it off the menu. But it you know, like it fit right in, and we didn't feel weird about that. So I don't know. I think that we have a very unique and creative staff, mm-hmm. and our sous chefs and chefs and cooks. You know, there's a lot of really great conversations that are happening every day in the restaurants. And it's a lot of conversations, but it's they're always centered around creativity. One thing that we really are very focused on not talking about at the restaurants in the kitchens, even though this is such an important discussion, is money. We don't talk about what things cost. We try not to. We're very fortunate that we don't have to, and we use a lot of like humble ingredients in our cooking, which helps, but I try not to let the creative conversation revolve around money. And that's really important. So we do it once a month when we meet. Actually, it's now every other month. Each restaurant gets once a month. And that's when we talk about our P&Ls. And if it's really crazy, we address it. But if it's not, we just try to let creativity drive. And ultimately, it can pay off, and it can work in a way that costs find their home.
So there's an Inforum tradition of ending the conversation with a question, which is, what is your 60-second idea for changing the world? So I'm going to make it 30 seconds apiece,
okay,
just because
awesome.
I know we're running short on time. Yeah. Who wants to go first?
I will. In the past, I would say drink more peanut milk, but now you can make it. And it's called world peace, so I feel like it's a really good answer to that question. So now you can make and drink more world peace.
That's it?
That's it.
Oh, man. I'm still trying to think of mine here. I would say something that's worked really well for us and that we really practice heavy is knowing everybody's first name that comes into the restaurant, as far as like our community of purveyors and people who bring things to the restaurant, is been really important. And so it's sort of understanding the locale of local, and thinking of food is not as something that satisfies you, but as something that is that is really based around a relationship.
All right, thank you. Well, let's give a round of applause to Stuart and Nicole showing up at the Commonwealth Inforum at the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Well, thank you.
They'll be in the lobby signing copies of the cookbook. If you have a copy, you want to have them sign or buy a copy there. Thanks again for coming.
Excellent.
Thank you.